You'll never get the whole truth, of course. How could you? You're a very clever man, but what you do doesn't result in justice. There's the justice of men and the justice of God. Dudley said, I'm not that arrogant, Father. I limit my ambition to the justice of men, or as close to it as I can get. And even that isn't in my hands. It's my job to make an arrest. The jury decide on guilt or innocence, the judge sentences. And the result is justice? Not always. Perhaps even not often. But in an imperfect world, it may be as close to it as we can get. Father Martin said, I'm not denying the importance of truth. How could I? I'm simply saying that the search for it can be dangerous, and so can the truth when it's discovered. You suggest that we should have the Anselm Papyrus examined, the truth established by carbon dating. But that wouldn't stop the controversy. People would argue that the papyrus is so convincing that it must be a copy of an earlier and genuine one. Others would choose not to believe the experts. We would face years of damaging controversy. There would always be something mysterious about the papyrus. We don't want to set up another Turin shroud. There was a question which Dalgliesh wanted to ask, but he hesitated, aware of its presumption, aware, too, that once spoken it would be answered honestly and perhaps with pain. Father, if the papyrus were examined, and it were possible to know with almost complete certainty that it was genuine, would that make a difference to your faith? Father Martin smiled. He said, My son, for one who every hour of his life has the assurance of the living presence of Christ, why should I worry about what happened to earthly bones? In the office below, Father Sebastian had asked Emma to come and see him. Sitting her in a chair, he said, I expect you wish to go back to Cambridge as soon as possible. I've spoken to Mr. Dalgliesh, and he says that he has no objection. I understand that at present he has no power to keep anyone here who wishes to leave, provided the police know how to contact them. There's no question, of course, of any of the priests or ordinands leaving. Irritation, amounting to outrage, made Emma's voice sharper than she realized. You mean that you and Mr. Dalgliesh have been discussing what I should or should not do? Father, isn't that for you and me to decide? Father Sebastian bent his head for a moment, then looked her in the eyes. I'm sorry, Emma. I've expressed myself clumsily. It wasn't like that. I rather assumed that you would wish to leave. But why? Why should you assume that? My child, there's a murderer among us. We have to face that. I should be easier in my mind if you were not here. I know that we have no reason to suppose that any of us is in danger at St. Anselm's, but it can't be a very happy or peaceful place for you, for anyone. Emma's voice was more gentle. That doesn't mean I want to leave it. You said that the college should continue with its daily life as far as possible. I thought that meant I would stay and give my usual 3 seminars. I don't see what that has got to do with the police. Nothing, Emma. I spoke to Dalgliesh because I knew you and I would have to have this discussion. Before doing so, I thought I ought to find out whether any of us is, in fact, free to leave. It would have been pointless to discuss your wishes until I'd ascertained that. You must forgive my tactlessness. We are all, to some extent, the prisoners of our upbringing. I'm afraid my instinct is to thrust women and children into the lifeboats. He smiled, then said, It's a habit my wife used to complain of. Emma asked, What about Mrs. Pilbeam and Karen Surtees? Are they leaving? He hesitated and gave a rueful smile. Emma was even able to laugh. Oh, Father, you aren't going to tell me that they're both all right because they have a man to protect them. No, I wasn't proposing to aggravate my offence. Miss Surtees has told the police that she intends to remain with her brother until an arrest is made. She may be here some time. I take it that it will be she who will be doing the protecting. I have suggested to the Pilbeams that Mrs. Pilbeam should visit one of her married sons, but she asked with some asperity who, in that case, would be doing the cooking. Emma was struck with an uncomfortable thought. She said, "I'm sorry I was so sharp, and perhaps I'm being selfish. If it would be easier for you, for everyone, if I left, then of course I'll go. I didn't mean to be a bother or to increase your anxieties. I was just thinking of what I wanted." "Then please stay. Your presence, particularly for the next 3 days, may add to my anxiety, but it will immeasurably add to our comfort and peace. You have always been good for this place, Emma. You are good for it now." Again their eyes met, and she had no doubt of what she saw in his, pleasure and relief. She looked away, aware that he might discern in her eyes a less acceptable emotion, pity. She thought, "He's not young, and this is terrible for him, perhaps the end of everything he's worked for and loved." 17. Lunch at St. Anselm's was a simpler meal than dinner, consisting generally of soup followed by a variety of salads with cold meats and a hot vegetarian dish. Like dinner, it was eaten partly in silence. Today the silence was particularly welcome to Emma, and, she suspected, to everyone present. When the community were together, silence seemed the only possible response to a tragedy that in its bizarre horror was as much beyond speech as it was beyond comprehension. And silence at St. Anselm's was always a benison, more positive than the mere absence of speech. Now it invested the meal with a brief illusion of normality. Little was eaten, however, and even the soup bowls were pushed aside half-empty while Mrs. Pilbeam, white-faced, moved among them like an automaton. Emma had planned to return to Ambrose to work, but knew that concentration would be impossible. On an impulse, which at first she found difficult to explain, she decided to see if George Gregory was in St. Luke's Cottage. He wasn't always resident in college when she visited, but when he was, they were easy in each other's company without ever being intimate. But now she needed to talk to someone who was in St. Anselm's, but not of it, someone with whom she need not weigh every word. It would be a relief to be able to discuss the murder with someone she suspected would find it more intriguing than personally distressing. Gregory was at home. The door of St. Luke's Cottage stood open, and even as she approached, she could hear that he was listening to Handel. She recognized the tape as one she owned herself, the countertenor James Bowman singing "Ombre My Fou." The voice of exquisite beauty and clarity swelled out over the headland. She waited until the music ended, and even as she lifted her hand to the knocker, he called out for her to come in. She passed through his ordered, book-lined study and into the glass extension overlooking the headland. He was drinking coffee, and the rich smell of it filled the room. She hadn't waited for coffee in college, but when he offered to fetch a second cup, she accepted. He placed a small table beside the low wicker chair, and she leaned back, surprisingly glad to be there. She had come with no clear ideas, but there was something she needed to say. She watched him as he poured the coffee. The goatee beard gave a slightly sinister Mephistophelian look to a face which she had always thought more handsome than attractive. He had a high sloping forehead, from which the fair hair sprang back in waves so regular that they looked as if they'd been produced by heated rollers. Under thin lids, his eyes regarded the world with an amused or ironic contempt. He looked after himself. She knew that he ran daily and swam, except in the coldest months of the year. As he handed her the cup, she saw again the deformity which he never made any attempt to conceal. The top half of the third finger on his left hand had been chopped off in adolescence in an accident with an axe. He had explained the circumstances to her at their first meeting, and she had realized that he needed to emphasize that it had been an accident and his own fault, not a birth defect. It had surprised her that he should so obviously resent and feel it necessary to explain a deformity that could hardly inconvenience him. It was, she thought, a measure of his self-regard. "Now," she said, "there's something I want to consult you about. No, that's the wrong word. Something I need to talk over." "I'm flattered. But why me? Wouldn't one of the priests be more appropriate?" "I can't worry Father Martin with it, and I know what Father Sebastian would say, at least I think I know, although he can be surprising." Gregory said, "But if it's a moral question, they're supposed to be the experts." "I suppose it is a moral question. At least it's an ethical question. But I'm not sure I want an expert. How far do you think we ought to cooperate with the police? How much should we tell them?" "That's the question, is it?" "That's the question." He said, "We may as well be specific. I suppose you do want Crampton's murderer caught? You haven't any problem with that? You don't feel that in certain circumstances murder ought to be condoned?" "No, I never feel that. I want all murderers caught. I'm not sure I know what ought to happen to them afterwards, but even if one feels empathy for them, perhaps even sympathy, I still want them caught." "But you don't want to take too active a part in the catching?" "I don't want to hurt the innocent." "Ah," he said. "But you can't help it. Dalgleish can't help it. That's what a murder investigation always does. It hurts the innocent." "Which particular innocent have you in mind?" "I'd rather not say." There was a silence. Then she said, "I don't know why I'm bothering you with this. I suppose I needed to talk to someone who isn't really part of the college." He said, "You're talking to me because I'm not important to you. You're not attracted to me sexually. You're content to be here because nothing we say to each other will change the relationship between us. There's nothing to be changed. You think I'm intelligent, honest, unshockable, and that you can trust me. All that is true. And, incidentally, you don't believe I murdered Crampton. You're perfectly right. I didn't. He made virtually no impact on me when he was alive, and he makes even less now he's dead. I admit to a natural curiosity about who killed him, but that's as far as it goes. And I should like to know how he died, but you're not going to tell me, and I shan't invite a rebuff by asking. But of course I'm involved. We all are. Dalgleish hasn't sent for me yet, but I don't deceive myself that it's because I'm low on his list of suspects." "So what will you say when he does?" "I shall answer his questions honestly. I shan't lie. If I'm asked for an opinion, I shall give it with extreme care. I shan't theorize, and I shan't volunteer information I'm not asked for. I certainly shan't attempt to do the police's work for them. They're paid enough, God knows. And I'll remember that I can always add to what I've told them. But words once spoken can't be recalled. That's what I plan to do. When Dalgleish or his minions condescend to call, I'll probably be too arrogant or too inquisitive to take my own advice. Is that helpful?" Emma said, "So you're saying, don't lie, but don't tell them more than you need. Wait until you're asked, and then answer truthfully." "More or less." She asked a question that she had wanted to ask since their first meeting. It was odd that today seemed the right time. "You're not in sympathy with St. Anselm's, are you? Is that because you're not a believer yourself, or because you don't think they are either?"
"Oh, they believe all right. It's just that what they believe has become irrelevant. I don't mean the moral teaching. The Judeo-Christian heritage has created Western civilization, and we should be grateful to it. But the church they serve is dying. When I look at the doom, I try to have some understanding of what it meant to 15th century men and women. If life is hard and short and full of pain, you need the hope of heaven. If there is no effective law, you need the deterrent of hell. The church gave them comfort and light and pictures and stories and the hope of everlasting life. The 21st century has other compensations. Football, for one. There you have ritual, colored drama, the sense of belonging. Football has its high priests, even its martyrs. And then there's shopping, art and music, travel, alcohol, drugs. We all have our own resources for staving off those two horrors of human life, boredom and the knowledge that we die. And now, God help us, There's the internet. Pornography at the touch of a few keys. If you want to find a pedophile ring or discover how to make a bomb to blow up people you disagree with, it's all there for you. Plus, of course, a bottomless mine of other information, some of it even accurate. Emma said, "But when all these things fail, even the music, the poetry, the art..." "Then, my dear, I shall turn to science. If my end promises to be unpleasant, I shall rely on morphine and the compassion of my doctor. Or perhaps I shall swim out to sea and take my last look at the sky." Emma asked, "Why do you stay here? Why did you take this job in the first place?" "Because I enjoy teaching ancient Greek to intelligent young men." "Why are you an academic?" "Because I enjoy teaching English literature to intelligent young men and women." "That's a partial answer. I do sometimes wonder where exactly I'm going. It would be good to do original creative work rather than analyze the creativity of others. Caught up in the thicket of the academic jungle. I've taken good care to avoid all that. This place suits me admirably. I have enough private money to ensure that I don't need to work full time. I have a life in London. Not one the fathers here would approve of. But I like the stimulus of contrast. I also need peace. Peace to write and peace to think. I get it here. I'm never troubled with visitors. I fend people off with the excuse that I've only one bedroom. I can eat in college when I feel like it and be assured of excellent food, wines which are always drinkable and occasionally memorable, and conversation, which is often stimulating and seldom boring. I enjoy solitary walking, and the desolation of this coast suits me. I get free accommodation and my keep, and the college pays a derisory stipend for teaching of a standard which they would otherwise find it difficult to attract or to afford. This murderer will put a stop to all that. I'm beginning seriously to resent him. What is so horrible is the knowledge that it could be someone here, someone we know. An inside job, as our dear police would say. Oh, it has to be, hasn't it? Come on, Emma, you're not a coward. Face the truth. What thief is going to drive in the dark and on a stormy night to a remote church, which he could hardly have expected to find open, in the hope of breaking into the offerings box and collecting a few dud coins? And the circle of suspects isn't exactly large. You're out, my dear. Of course, arriving first on the scene is always suspicious in detective fiction, to which I may say the priests here are addicted, but I think you can take it that you're in the clear. That leaves the four ordnance who were in college last night and seven others. The Pilbeams, Surtees and his sister, Yarwood, Stannard, and myself. I suppose even Dalglish doesn't seriously suspect any of our fathers in God, although he's probably keeping them in mind, particularly if he remembers his Pascal. Men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. Emma didn't want to discuss the priests. She said quietly, "Surely we can eliminate the Pilbeams." "Unlikely murderers, I admit, but then so are we all. But it would distress me to think of so good a cook serving a life sentence." "All right, delete the Pilbeams." Emma was about to say that the four ordnance could surely be eliminated too, but something held her back. She was afraid of what she might hear. Instead, she said, "And surely you're not a suspect. You had no reason to hate the Archdeacon. In fact, his murder could settle the question of closing St. Anselm's. Isn't that the last thing you want?" "It was coming anyway. The marvel is that the place has lasted so long. But you're right. I had no reason to wish Crampton dead. If I were capable of killing anyone, which I'm not, except in self-defense, it would more probably be Sebastian Morel."
"Father Sebastian? Why?"
"An old grudge. He stopped me becoming a fellow of All Souls. It isn't important now, but it mattered at the time. Oh, dear me, yes, it certainly mattered. He had just written a vicious review of my latest book, with a barely concealed hint that I'd been guilty of plagiarism. I hadn't. It was one of those unlikely coincidences of phrases and ideas which can occur, but the scandal didn't help. How horrible. Not really. It happens. You must know that. It's every writer's nightmare. But why did he give you this job? He can't have forgotten. He's never mentioned it. It's possible that he has forgotten. It was important to me at the time, but evidently not important to him. Even if he remembered when I applied for the job, I doubt whether it would have worried him. Not when it came to getting an excellent teacher for St. Anselm's and getting him cheap. Emma didn't reply. Looking down on her bent head, Gregory said, "Have some more coffee. Then you can tell me the latest Cambridge gossip." 18. When Dalgleish rang to ask George Gregory to come to St. Matthew's Cottage, Gregory said, "I'd hope that I might be interviewed here. I'm expecting a phone call from my agent, and she has this number. I have an intense dislike of mobile phones." A business call on a Sunday seemed to Dalgleish unlikely. As if sensing his skepticism, Gregory added, "I'm supposed to meet her for lunch in London tomorrow at the Ivy. I'd rather assume that this won't now be possible, or if possible, not convenient. I've tried to reach her, but without success. I've left a message on her answer phone asking her to ring me. Obviously, if I can't get a message to her today or early tomorrow, I'll have to go to London. I take it there's no objection." Dalgleish said, "I can see none at present. I would prefer everyone at St. Anselm's to remain here at least until the first part of the investigation is over. I've no wish to run away, I assure you. Quite the reverse. It's not every day one experiences vicariously the excitement of murder." Dalgleish said, "I don't think Miss Lavenham shares your pleasure in the experience." "Of course not, poor girl. But then she's seen the body. Without that visual impact of horror, murder is surely an atavistic frisson, more Agatha Christie than real. I know that imagined terror is supposed to be more potent than reality, but I can't believe that's true of murder. Surely no one who actually sees a murdered body can ever erase it from the mind." "You'll come over then. Thank you." Gregory's comment had been brutally insensitive, but he hadn't been altogether wrong. It had been as a raw detective recently appointed to the CID and kneeling beside the body of that first, never-to-be-forgotten victim that Dalgleish had first experienced, in a rush of shock, outrage and pity, murder's destructive power. He wondered how Emma Lavenham was coping, whether there was something he could or ought to do to help her. Probably not. She might well see any attempt as either an intrusion or condescension. There was no one at St. Anselm's to whom she could talk freely about what she had seen in the church, except Father Martin. And he, poor man, was more likely to need comfort and support than to be able to give it. She could, of course, leave and take her secret with her, but she wasn't a woman to run away. Why, without knowing her, was he so sure of that? Resolutely, he put the problem of Emma temporarily out of mind and applied himself to the task in hand. He was happy enough to see Gregory in St. Luke's Cottage. He had no intention of interviewing the ordnance in their own rooms or at their convenience. It was appropriate, expedient, and time-saving that they should come to him. But on his own ground, Gregory would be more at ease, and suspects at ease were more likely to let down their guard. He could learn far more about his witness from an unobtrusive scrutiny of his rooms than from a dozen direct questions. Books, pictures, the arrangement of artifacts sometimes provided more revealing testimony than words. As Dalgleish and Kate followed Gregory into the left-hand sitting room, he was struck again by the individuality of the three occupied cottages. From the Pilbeam's cheerful domestic comfort, Surtees' carefully ordered workroom with its smell of wood, turpentine, and animal food, to this, obviously the living space of an academic and one almost obsessively tidy. The cottage had been adapted to serve Gregory's two dominant interests, classical literature and music. The whole of the front room had been fitted with bookshelves from floor to ceiling, except above the ornate Victorian fireplace, where he had hung a print of Piranesi's Arch of Constantine.
It was clearly important to Gregory that the height of the shelves should be designed to accommodate precisely the size of the books, a foible which Dalgliesh shared, and the impression was of a room clad in the ordered richness of softly gleaming gold and brown leather. A plain oak desk holding a computer and a functional office chair stood beneath the window, which was uncurtained but fitted with a slatted wooden blind. They passed through an open doorway into the extension. It was chiefly of glass and stretched the whole length of the cottage. This was Gregory's sitting room, furnished with light but comfortable wicker chairs and a sofa, a drinks table, and a larger circular table at the far end, piled high with books and magazines. Even these were orderly, arranged, it would seem, according to size. The glass roof and sides were fitted with sun blinds, which in the summer, Dalgliesh thought, would be essential. Even now the south-facing room was comfortably warm. Outside stretched the bleak scrubland and a distant view of the treetops round the mere, and, to the east, the great grey sweep of the North Sea. The low chairs were not conducive to a police interrogation, but no other seating was available. Gregory's chair faced south, and he leaned back against the headrest and stretched out his long legs like a clubman, perfectly at ease. Dalgliesh began with questions to which he already knew the answers from his perusal of the personal files. Gregory's had been far less informative than those of the ordnance. The first document, a letter from Keble College, Oxford, had made plain by what means he had come to St. Anselm's. Dalgliesh, who had almost total recall of the written word, had no difficulty in remembering it. "Now that Bradley has finally retired, and how on earth did you persuade him? Rumor has it that you are looking for a replacement. I wonder if you've thought of George Gregory. I understand he's busy at present on a new translation of Euripides and is looking for a part-time post, preferably in the country where he can get on with this major work in peace. Academically, of course, you could not do better, and he's a fine teacher. It's the usual story of the scholar who never quite fulfills his potential. He is not the easiest of men, but I think that he might suit you. He had a word with me when he dined here last Friday. I made no promise, but said I would find out how you are placed. I gather that money is a consideration, but not the main one. It's the privacy and the peace he's really after." "Now," Dalgliesh said, "you came here in 1995, and by invitation."
"You could say I was headhunted.
The college wanted an experienced teacher with classical Greek and some Hebrew. I wanted a part-time teaching job, preferably in the country with accommodation. I have a house in Oxford, but it's let at present. The tenant is responsible, and the rent high. It's not an arrangement I want to upset. Father Martin would have called our coming together providential. Father Sebastian saw it as one more example of his power to order events to his and the college's advantage. I can't speak for St. Anselm's, but I don't think either party has regretted the arrangement."
"When did you first meet Archdeacon Crampton?"
"On his first visit, about 3 months ago, when he was appointed as a trustee. I can't remember the exact date. He came again 2 weeks ago, and then yesterday. On the second occasion, he went to some trouble to seek me out and inquire on what terms precisely I thought I was employed here. I got the impression that if not discouraged, he would begin to catechize me about my religious convictions, if any. I referred him to Sebastian Morel on the first matter and was sufficiently disobliging on the second to send him off to seek out easier victims. Certes, I suspect."
"And this visit?"
"I didn't see him until dinner yesterday. Not a particularly festive occasion, but you were there yourself, so you saw and heard as much as I did, probably more. After dinner, I left without waiting for coffee and came back here."
"And the rest of the night, Mr. Gregory?"
"Spent in this cottage. Some reading, some revision, marking half a dozen students' essays, then music. Wagner last night, and bed. And, to save you the trouble of asking, I didn't leave the cottage at any time during the night. I saw no one, and I heard nothing except the storm."
"And you learned of the Archdeacon's murder when?"
When Raphael Arbuthnot rang at about 7:15 to say that Father Sebastian had called an emergency meeting of all residents in the library at 7:30. He gave no explanation, and it wasn't until we all congregated as instructed that I learned of the murder. What was your reaction to the news? Complicated. Mostly, I suppose, initial shock and disbelief. I didn't know the man, so I had no reason to feel personal grief or regret. That charade in the library was extraordinary, wasn't it? Trust Morell to set up something like that. I take it that it was his idea. There we all stood and sat like members of a dysfunctional family waiting for the will to be read. I've said that my first reaction was one of shock, and of course it was. But it was shock, I felt, not surprise. When I came into the library and saw Emma Lavenham's face, I realized that this was serious. I think I knew even before Morell spoke what he was going to tell us. You knew that Archdeacon Crampton wasn't exactly a welcome visitor at St. Anselm's? I tried to distance myself from college politics. Small and remote institutions like this can become hotbeds of gossip and innuendo, but I'm not exactly blind and deaf. I think most of us know that the future of St. Anselm's is uncertain, and that Archdeacon Crampton was determined that it should close sooner rather than later. Would the closure inconvenience you? I won't welcome it, but I saw it as a probability soon after I arrived. But, considering the speed with which the Church of England moves, I thought I was safe for at least another 10 years. I shall regret losing the cottage, particularly as I paid for the extension. I find this place congenial for my work, and I'll be sorry to leave it. There's a chance, of course, that I may not have to. I don't know what the church will do with the building, but it won't be an easy property to sell. It's possible I may be able to buy the cottage. It's early days to be giving it much thought, and I don't even know whether it belongs to the church commissioners or to the diocese. That world is alien to me. So either Gregory was unaware of the terms of Miss Arbuthnot's will, or he was taking care to conceal his knowledge. There seemed nothing more to be learned for the present, and Gregory began to edge himself out of his armchair. But Dalgleish hadn't finished. He said, "Was Ronald Treves one of your pupils?" "Of course. I teach classical Greek and Hebrew to all the ordinands, except those who read grades. Treves' degree was in geography. That meant he was taking the 3-year course here and starting Greek from scratch." "Of course, I was forgetting. You came here originally to look into that death. It seems comparatively unimportant now, doesn't it?" "Anyway, it always was unimportant. As a putative murder, I mean. The more logical verdict would have been suicide." "Was that your view when you saw the body?" "It was a view I formed as soon as I had time to think calmly. It was the folded clothes that convinced me. A young man proposing to climb a cliff doesn't arrange his cloak and cassock with such ritual care. He came here for some private tuition on the Friday evening, before Compline, and seemed much as usual. That means he wasn't particularly cheerful, but then he never was. I can't remember that we had any conversation except that which related to the translation he had worked on. I left for London immediately afterwards and stayed the night at my club. It was as I was driving back on Saturday afternoon that I was stopped by Mrs. Munro." Kate asked, "What was he like?" "Ronald Treves, stolid, hard-working, intelligent, but not perhaps quite as clever as he thought. Insecure, remarkably intolerant for a young man. I think Papa played a dominant part in his life. I suppose that could have accounted for his choice of job. If you can't succeed in Papa's field, you can be as disobliging in your choice as possible. But we never discussed his private life. I make it a rule not to get involved with the ordinance. That way lies disaster, particularly in a small college like this. I'm here to teach them Greek and Hebrew, not to delve into their psyches. When I say that I need privacy, that includes privacy from the pressure of human personality. By the way, when are you expecting the news of this murder to break? Publicly, I mean. I suppose we can expect the usual influx of the media?" Dalgleish said, "Obviously it can't be kept secret indefinitely. I'm discussing with Father Sebastian how the public relations branch can help. When there's anything to say, We'll hold a press conference. And there's no objection to my leaving for London today?
I have no power to prevent you.
Gregory got slowly to his feet.
All the same, I think I'll cancel tomorrow's luncheon. I've a feeling there will be more to interest me here than in a tedious discussion of my publisher's delinquencies and the minutiae of my new contract.
I suppose you would prefer me not to explain why I'm cancelling.
It would be helpful at the moment.
Gregory was moving to the door.
A pity. I'd rather enjoy explaining that I can't come to London because I'm a suspect in a murder inquiry.
Goodbye, Commander. If you need me again, you know where to find me.
19. The squad ended the day as they had begun it, conferring together in St. Matthew's Cottage. But now they were in the more comfortable of the two rooms, sitting on the sofa and in the armchairs, and drinking the last coffee of the day. It was time to assess progress. The time and place of the telephone call to Mrs. Crampton had been checked. It had been made from the instrument with the honesty box beside it, mounted on the wall in the corridor outside Mrs. Pilbeam's sitting room. The call had been made at 9:28. This was one more piece of evidence, and an important one. It proved what they had suspected from the first, that the killer was in St. Anselm's. Piers had followed up the discovery. He said, "If we're right, and the caller later rang the Archdeacon's mobile, then everyone who attended Compline is in the clear. That leaves us with Surtees and his sister, Gregory, Inspector Yarwood, the Pilbeams, and Emma Lavenham. I don't suppose any of us see Dr. Lavenham as a serious suspect, and we're discounting Stannard."
Dalgleish said, "Not entirely. We've no power to hold him, and I'm pretty certain he has no idea how Crampton died. That doesn't necessarily mean he wasn't implicated. He's out of St. Anselm's, but not out of mind."
Pierce said, "There's one thing, though. Arbuthnot only just arrived in the sacristy in time for the service. I got that bit of information from Father Sebastian, who had no idea, of course, of its importance. Robbins and I have checked, sir. Both of us could run from the door into the south cloister and across the courtyard in 10 seconds. He'd just have had time to make the call and get to the church by 9:30.
Kate said, "It'd be risky, wouldn't it? Anyone could have seen him.
In the dark, and with the dim lights in the cloister, and who was there to see him? They were in church. It wasn't much of a risk."
Robin said, "I wonder if it would be premature, sir, to exclude everyone in church. Suppose Cain had an accomplice. There's nothing to show that this was a one-man crime. Anyone who was actually in the church before 9:28 couldn't have made the call, but that doesn't mean one of them wasn't implicated in the murder."
Pierce said, "A conspiracy? Well, it could be. There were enough of them here who hated him. A one-man and one-woman crime, maybe. When Kate and I interviewed the Surteeses, it was pretty obvious that they were hiding something. Eric was frankly terrified." The only suspect who had produced anything of interest had been Karen Surtees. She had claimed that neither she nor her brother had left St. John's Cottage at any time during the evening. They had watched television until 11 and then had gone to bed. Asked by Kate whether either of them could have left the cottage without the other knowing, she had said, "That's a pretty crude way of asking whether either of us went out in a storm to murder the Archdeacon. Well, we didn't. And if you think Eric could have left the cottage without my knowing, the answer is no. We slept in the same bed, if you must know. I'm actually his half-sister, and even if I weren't, you're investigating murder, not incest, and it's none of your business anyway."
Dalgleish said, "And you were both convinced she was telling the truth?"
Kate said, "One look at her brother's face showed us that. I don't know whether she's told him what she proposed to say, but he didn't like it. And it's odd, isn't it, that she bothered to tell us that? She could perfectly well have said that the storm kept them both awake for most of the night and provided an alibi that way. Okay, I think she's a woman who likes to shock, but that doesn't seem reason enough for telling us about the incest, if that's what it is."
Pierce said, "It shows she was damned anxious to provide an alibi, though, doesn't it?
It's almost as if the two of them are thinking ahead, telling the truth now, because in the end they might have to rely on it in court.
A twig had been found in Raphael Abathnot's set in the North Cloister, but the Sokos had discovered nothing else of interest. During the day, Dalgliesh had become confirmed in his initial view of its importance. If he were right in his theory, the twig was indeed a vital clue. But he judged that to voice his suspicions now would be premature. They discussed the results of the individual interviews. Except for Raphael, everyone in college or in the cottages claimed to have been virtuously in bed by 11:30 and, although occasionally disturbed by the force of the wind, to have seen or heard nothing unusual during the night. Father Sebastian had been cooperative but cool. It was only with difficulty that he had concealed his dislike of being interviewed by subordinates, and he had begun by saying that he could spare only a short time as he was expecting Mrs. Crampton to arrive. A short time was all that was necessary. The warden's story was that he had worked on an article he was contributing to a theological journal until 11, and had been in bed by 11:30 after his usual nightcap of whiskey. Father John Betterton and his sister had read until 10:30, after which Miss Betterton had brewed cocoa for them both. The Pilbeams had watched television and had fortified themselves against a stormy night with copious cups of tea. By 8 o'clock it was time to end for the day. The Sokos had long departed to their hotel, and now Kate, Piers, and Robbins said their good nights. Tomorrow, Kate and Robbins would drive to Ashcombe House to see what, if anything, could be learned about Margaret Munro's time there. Dalgliesh locked up the papers he needed to keep private in his briefcase and walked across the headland into the western court to Jerome. The telephone rang. It was Mrs. Pilbeam. Father Sebastian had suggested that Commander Dalgliesh might like to have dinner in his set. It would save him the journey to Southwold. It would only be soup, followed by salad and cold meat and some fruit, but if that was enough, Pilbeam would be happy to bring it over. Glad to be spared the car journey, Dalgliesh thanked her and said that the meal would be very welcome. It arrived within 10 minutes, carried by Pilbeam. Dalgliesh suspected that he was unwilling for his wife to walk even the short distance across the courtyard after dark. Now, with surprising dexterity, he drew the desk a little away from the wall, laid the table, and set out the meal. Pilbeam said, "If you just leave the tray outside, sir, I'll fetch it in about an hour." The thermos contained minestrone soup thick with vegetables and pasta, obviously homemade. Mrs. Pilbeam had provided a bowl of grated Parmesan cheese, and there were hot rolls wrapped in a napkin and butter. Under the cover was a plate of salad and excellent ham. Someone, perhaps Father Sebastian, had supplied a bottle of claret, although not a wine glass. But Dalgliesh, unwilling to drink alone, put it in the cupboard and after the meal brewed himself coffee. He placed the tray outside and minutes later heard Pilbeam's heavy tread on the stones of the cloister. He opened the door to say thank you and good night. He found himself in that discouraging state of physical tiredness and mental stimulation which is fatal to sleep. The silence was eerie, and when he went to the window he saw the college as a black silhouette, chimneys, tower and cupola, an unbroken mass against a paler sky. The blue and white police tape was still looped around the columns of the North Cloister, which was now almost clear of leaves. In the glow from the light above the south cloister door, the cobbles of the courtyard glistened, and the fuchsia looked as unnaturally bright and incongruous as a splash of red paint flung against the stone wall. He settled down to read, but the peace around him found no echo within. What was it, he wondered, about this place which made him feel that his life was under judgment? He thought about the long years of self-imposed solitude since his wife's death. Hadn't he used his job to avoid the commitment of love, to keep inviolate more than that high, uncluttered flat above the Thames, which, when he returned to it at night, looked exactly the same as it had when he left it in the morning? To be a detached observer of life was not without dignity.
to have a job which preserved your own privacy while providing you with the excuse, indeed the duty, to invade the privacy of others, had its advantages for a writer. But wasn't there something ignoble about it? If you stood apart long enough, weren't you in danger of stifling, perhaps even losing, that quickening spirit which the priests here would call the soul? 6 lines of verse came into his mind, and he took a page of paper, ripped it in half, and wrote them down. Epitaph for a dead poet. Buried at last, who was so wise, 6 foot by 3, in clay he lies. Where no hands reach, where no lips move, where no voice importunes his love. How odd he cannot know nor see this last fine self-sufficiency. After a second he scribbled beneath it, with apologies to Marvel. He thought back to the days when his poetry had come as easily as had this light, ironic verse. Now it was a more cerebral, a more calculated choice and arrangement of words. Was there anything in his life that was spontaneous? He told himself that this introspection was becoming morbid. To shake it off, he had to get out of St. Anselm's. What he needed before bed was a brisk walk. He closed the door to Jerome, past Ambrose, from which no lights were visible behind the tightly drawn curtains, and, unlocking the iron gate, turned resolutely south, making his way towards the sea. 20. It was Miss Arbuthnot who had decreed that there should be no locks on the doors of the ordnance rooms. Emma wondered what she had feared they might do, if not always at risk of interruption. Had there been perhaps an unacknowledged fear of sexuality? Perhaps, as a consequence, no locks had been fitted in the visitors' sets. The locked iron gate by the church gave all the nighttime security considered necessary. Behind that elegantly designed barrier, what was there to fear? Because there was no tradition of locks and bolts, none were available in college to be fitted, and Pilbeam had been too busy all day to go to Lowestoft to buy them, even if he could have found a shop open on a Sunday. Father Sebastian had asked Emma whether she would be more comfortable in the main building. Emma, unwilling to betray nervousness, had assured the warden that she would be perfectly all right. Father Sebastian hadn't asked her again, and when she returned to the set after Compline to discover that locks hadn't been fitted, she was too proud to seek him out, confess her fear, and say that she had changed her mind. She undressed and put on her dressing gown, then settled down at her laptop and resolutely tried to work. But she was too tired. Thoughts and words came in a jumble, overlaid by the events of the day. It had been late in the morning before Robbins had sought her out and asked her to come to the interview room. There, Dalgleish, with Inspector Miskin on his left, had taken her briefly through the events of the previous night. Emma had explained how she had been woken by the wind, and had heard the clear note of the bell. She couldn't explain why she had put on her dressing gown and gone down to investigate. It now seemed rash and stupid. She thought she must have been half asleep, or perhaps the single chime heard through the wind had woken a semi-conscious memory of the insistent bells of childhood and adolescence. A call to be sharply obeyed, not questioned. But she had been fully awake when she had pushed open the church door and seen between the pillars the brightly lit doom and the two figures, the one prone and the other collapsed over him in an attitude of pity or despair. Dalgleish hadn't asked her to describe the scene in detail. Why should he, she thought? He'd been there. He didn't express sympathy or concern for what she'd gone through, but then it wasn't she who was bereaved. The questions were clear and simple. It wasn't, she thought, that he had been trying to spare her. If there had been anything he wanted to know, he would have asked, whatever her distress. When Sergeant Robbins had first shown her into the interview room and Commander Dalgleish had risen from his chair and invited her to sit, she had told herself, "I'm not facing the man who wrote A Case to Answer and other poems. I'm facing a policeman." In this, they could never be allies. There were people she loved and wanted to protect.
He had no allegiance except to the truth, and at the end had come to the question she had dreaded. Did Father Martin speak when you went up to him?
She had paused before replying.
Yes, just a few words.
What were they, Dr. Lavenham?
She didn't reply. She wouldn't lie, but even to recall the words now seemed an act of treachery.
The silence lengthened. Then he said, Dr. Lavenham, you saw the body. You saw what had been done to the Archdeacon. He was a tall, strong man. Father Martin is nearly 80 years old and becoming feeble. The brass candlestick, if it proves to be the weapon, would take some strength to wield.
Do you really believe Father Martin could have done it?
She had cried out vehemently. Of course not. He's incapable of cruelty. He's kind and loving and good, the best man I know. I never thought that. No one could.
Commander Dalglish had said quietly, Then why do you suppose I do?
He asked the question again. Emma looked him in the eyes. He said, Oh God, what have we done? What have we done?
And what do you suppose, thinking about it later, he meant by that?
She had thought about it later. They had not been words to forget. Nothing about that scene would ever be forgotten. She kept her eyes on her interrogator. I think he meant that the Archdeacon would still be alive if he hadn't come to St. Anselm's. Perhaps he wouldn't have been murdered if his killer hadn't known how strongly he was disliked here. That dislike could have contributed to his death. The college can't be guiltless.
Yes, he had said more gently. That's what Father Martin has told me he meant.
She looked at her watch. It was 11:20. Knowing that it would be impossible to work, she went up to her bed. Because the set of rooms was at the end of the row, the bedroom had two windows, one of which looked out over the south wall of the church. She drew the curtains before getting into bed and tried resolutely to forget the unlocked door. She shut her eyes, only to find images of death bubbling like blood on her retina, reality made more terrible by imagination. She saw again the viscous pool of spilt blood, but now there lay above it, like grey vomit, a spatter of his brains. The grotesque images of the damned and grinning devils jerked into life and animated their obscene gestures. When she opened her eyes in the hope of banishing horror, the darkness of the bedroom pressed upon her. Even the air smelt of death. She got out of bed and, unlatching the window facing the scrubland, pushed it open. There came a blessed rush of air, and she gazed out over the vast silence and a sky pricked with stars. She went back to bed, but sleep wouldn't come. Her legs were juddering with tiredness, but fear was stronger than exhaustion. At last she got up and went downstairs. To watch in darkness that unlocked door was less traumatic than to imagine it opening slowly. To be in the sitting room was better than lying helpless, waiting to hear those purposeful footsteps on the stairs. She wondered whether to ram a chair under the door handle, but couldn't bring herself to an action that seemed both demeaning and ineffectual. She despised herself for cowardice, telling herself that no one intended her harm. But then the images of cracked bones came back into her mind. Someone on the headland, perhaps someone in the college, had taken a brass candlestick and smashed the Archdeacon's skull, striking again and again in a frenzy of bloodlust and hatred. Could that have been the action of someone sane? Was anyone at St. Anselm's safe? It was then that she heard the rasp of the iron gate opening, the click as it was shut. Footsteps were passing. They were confident, but quiet. There was nothing furtive about this tread. Carefully she opened her door and glanced out, her heart thumping. Commander Dalglish was opening the door of Jerome. She must have made some sound, because he turned and came over to her, and she opened the door to him. The relief of seeing him, of seeing any human being, was overwhelming. She knew that it must show in her face. He said, Are you all right? She managed a smile. Not very at present, but I shall be. I was finding it difficult to sleep.
He said, I thought you would have moved to the main house. Didn't Father Sebastian suggest it?
He did offer, but I thought I'd be all right here.
He looked across at the church. He said, this isn't a good set for you. Would you like to change with me? I think you'd find it more comfortable.
She found it difficult to conceal her relief.
But wouldn't that be a bother?
Not in the slightest. We could move most of our things tomorrow.
All you need now are bedclothes.
I'm afraid your undersheet may not fit my bed. Mine's a double. She said, shall we just change our pillows and duvets?
Good idea.
Carrying them into Jerome, she saw that he had already brought his own pillows and duvet downstairs and had laid them on one of the armchairs. Beside them was a canvas and leather grip. Perhaps he had put together the things he needed for the night and next day. Going over to the cupboard, he said, the college has provided the usual innocuous drinks for us, and there's half a pint of milk in the fridge. Would you like cocoa or Ovaltine? Or, if you prefer, I've a bottle of claret.
I'd like some wine, please.
He shifted the duvet for her, and she sat down. He took a bottle, a corkscrew, and two tumblers from the small cupboard. Obviously, the college doesn't expect its guests to be drinking wine. We have the choice of tumblers or mugs.
A tumbler is fine, but it means opening a new bottle.
The best time to open it? When it's needed. She was surprised how much at ease she felt with him.
That's all I needed, she told herself. Someone else to be here.
They didn't talk for long, only until a single glass of wine had been finished. They drank slowly. He spoke of coming to the college as a boy, of the fathers, their cassocks hitched up, bowling to him on a pitch behind the west gate, cycling into Lowestoft to buy fish, the pleasure of solitary reading in the library at night. He asked about the syllabus for her class at St. Anselm's, how she chose the poets to study, what kind of response she got from the ordinance. The murder wasn't mentioned. Their talk wasn't desultory, but neither was it forced. She liked the sound of his voice. She had the sensation that part of her mind was detached, floating above them and being soothed by this low male and female contrapuntal sound. When she got up and said good night, he rose at once and said with a formality he hadn't shown so far, I shall be spending the night in this armchair, unless you object. If Inspector Miskin had been here, I'd have asked her to stay. As she isn't, I'll take her place, unless you'd rather I didn't. She recognized that he was trying to make it easy for her, that he didn't want to impose, but that he knew how much she dreaded being alone. She said, but won't that be a terrible nuisance? You'll have an uncomfortable night.
I shall be very comfortable. I'm used to sleeping in armchairs.
The bedroom in Jerome was almost identical to the one next door. The bedside lamp was switched on, and she saw that he had not taken his books. He had been reading, or surely it must have been rereading, Beowulf. There was an old and faded Penguin paperback, David Cecil's early Victorian novelists, with a photograph of the writer looking ridiculously young, and on the back, the price, in old money. So, like her, she thought. He enjoyed picking up books in second-hand shops. The third book was Mansfield Park. She wondered whether to take them down to him, but was reluctant to intrude now that they had said their good nights. It was strange to be lying on his sheet. She hoped that he didn't despise her for her cowardice. The relief of knowing that he was downstairs was immense. She closed her eyes on darkness, not on the dancing images of death, and in minutes she was asleep. She awoke after a dreamless night and saw from her watch that it was 7 o'clock. The set was very quiet, and when she went downstairs, she saw that he had already left, taking the duvet and pillow with him. He had opened the window, as if anxious that not even the faintest trace of his breath should remain. She knew that he would tell no one where he had spent the night.
Book 3. Voices from the Past. 1. Ruby Pilbeam needed no alarm clock. For 18 years she had woken winter and summer at 6 o'clock. She did so on Monday morning, stretching out her hand to switch on the bedside light. Immediately Reg stirred, pushed back the bedclothes, and began to edge out of the bed. There came to Ruby the warm smell of his body, bringing as always its familiar comfort. She wondered if he had been asleep or just lying still, waiting for her to move. Neither had slept, except for brief periods of restless half-slumber, and at 3 o'clock they had got up and gone down to the kitchen to drink tea and wait for the morning. Then exhaustion had mercifully taken over from shock and horror, and at 4 o'clock they had gone back to bed. They had then slept fitfully, but they had slept. Both had been busy all Sunday, and only the ceaseless, purposeful activity had given that dreadful day any semblance of normality. Last night, huddled together at the kitchen table, they'd talked about the murder, whispering as if those small, comfortable rooms of St. Mark's Cottage were crammed with secret listeners. The talk had been guarded, with suspicions unvoiced, broken sentences, and periods of unhappy silence. Even to say that it was absurd to suggest that anyone at St. Anselm's could be the murderer was to associate place and deed in treasonable proximity. To speak a name, even in exoneration, was to admit the thought that someone resident in college could have perpetrated such evil. But they had arrived at two possible theories, the more comforting because they induced belief. Together, before returning to bed, they had mentally rehearsed the stories like a mantra. Someone had stolen the keys to the church. Someone who had visited St. Anselm's, perhaps months earlier, and knew where they were kept and that Miss Ramsay's office was never locked. The same person had made an assignation with Archdeacon Crampton before he arrived on Saturday. Why meet in the church? What better place? They couldn't meet in the guest set without risk, and there was nowhere private on the headland. Perhaps the Archdeacon had himself taken the keys and unlocked the church, ready for his visitor. Then the arrival, the quarrel, the murderous rage. Perhaps the visitor had planned murder, had come with a weapon, a gun, a cosh, a knife. They hadn't been told how the Archdeacon had died, but both privately visualized the flash and thrust of a knife blade. And then the escape, a climb over the iron gate, leaving as he had entered. The second theory was even more plausible, adding weight to reassurance. The Archdeacon borrowed the keys and had gone to the church for purposes of his own. The intruder was a thief seeking to steal the altar picture or the silver. The Archdeacon had surprised him, and the thief in terror had struck. This explanation, once tacitly accepted as rational, neither Ruby nor her husband spoke again that night of the murder. Usually Ruby went alone to the college. Breakfast wasn't until 8 o'clock, following the 7:30 Mass, but Ruby liked to get started with planning her day. Father Sebastian breakfasted in his own sitting room, and there was his table to be laid ready for his invariable first meal of fresh orange juice, coffee, and 2 wholemeal slices of toast, with Ruby's homemade marmalade. At 8:30, Mrs. Bardwell and Mrs. Stacy, her daily domestic helpers, would arrive from Raiden, driven by Mrs. Bardwell in her old Ford. But not today. Father Sebastian had telephoned them both and asked them to delay their return for a couple of days. Ruby wondered what explanation he had given, but hadn't liked to ask. It meant more work for her and Reg, but Ruby was glad to be spared their avid curiosity, their speculations, their inevitable exclamations of horror. It occurred to her that murder might even be enjoyable for people who didn't know the victim and weren't under suspicion. Elsie Bardwell would certainly make the most of it. Usually Reg came over to the house later than 6:30, but today they left St. Mark's Cottage together. He gave no explanation, but she knew why it was. St. Anselm's was no longer a safe and holy place. He shone the beam of his strong torch along the beaten grass path to the iron gate leading to the west court. The faint haze of first light was creeping over the scrubland, but it seemed to her that she walked in an impenetrable darkness. Red shone his torch on the gate to find the keyhole. Beyond the gate, the row of dim lights in the cloisters illumined the slender pillars and cast shadows over the stone paths. The north cloister was still taped, and half its length was now free of leaves. The trunk of the horse chestnut rose black and still from the welter of fallen leaves. When the beams of the torch briefly passed over the fuchsia on the east wall, its red flowers glistened like drops of blood. In the corridor which separated her sitting room from the kitchen, Ruby put out her hand to switch on the light. But the darkness wasn't total. Ahead, the corridor was lit by a beam of light from the open cellar door. She said, "That's funny, Reg. The cellar door's open. Someone's up early. Or didn't you see that it was shut last night?" He said, "It was shut last night. Do you think I'd have left it open?" They moved to the head of the stone stairs. They were brightly lit by powerful overhead lights and fitted with a strong wooden handrail on each side. At the bottom of the steps, clearly seen in the glare from the light, was the sprawled body of a woman. Ruby gave a sharp, protesting cry. "Oh, God, Reg, it's Miss Betterton." Reg pushed Ruby aside. He said, "Stay here, lass," and she heard the clatter of his shoes on the stone. She hesitated only for a few seconds, then followed him down, clutching with both hands at the left handrail, and together they knelt by the body. She was lying on her back, her head towards the bottom step. There was a single gash to her forehead, but only an oozing of dried blood and serum. She was wearing a faded dressing gown in paisley wool, and under it a white cotton nightdress. Her thin grey hair stuck out from the side of her head in a plait, the wispy end held together by a twisted rubber band. Her eyes, fixed on the top of the stairs, were open and lifeless. Ruby whispered, "Oh, dear God, no. Your poor soul, your poor soul." She put an arm across the body in an instinctive gesture which she knew at once was futile. She could smell in the hair and from the dressing gown the sun.